Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, with Trump gone, where does the left go now? Our most eminent leftist intellectual, Noam Chomsky, has some very good ideas on the subject. I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm pleased to report that Noam Chomsky and I are getting more similar every day. No, I'm not getting smarter, better educated, and more respected. Here's what changed. Chomsky and I now both have gray hair, quite shaggy at the sides, and a full gray beard that appears to have been trimmed with electric clippers at the bathroom mirror. Yes, after 92 years, the formerly clean-shaven Chomsky has adopted my look. But on subjects other than beauty and grooming, Chomsky is as brilliant as ever, as we shall hear this week and next, in a sort of State of the Resistance address. In an hour-long interview on the Jacobin Channel, Chomsky explores how the left should respond now that the Trump administration is behind us. Chomsky stresses that class warfare in America is ongoing and has been ongoing since at least 1789, to go back no further. He reminds us that political gains are never permanent. They can be taken away, but losses are seldom permanent either. Look at the labor movement, smashed in the 19-teens and 20s, resurgent in the 1930s. As usual, Chomsky here takes the long view of almost every problem, and surprisingly, that view often is optimistic. In several respects, he says, Americans are better off now than we were in, say, 1960. Little thanks to the Democratic Party. The gains came from organized citizens who forced the politicians to pass much-needed progressive reforms. Chomsky notes that, after Obama's election, progressives foolishly obeyed Obama's instructions to back off, go away, and let him take care of everything. Obama then betrayed most of his supporters. He advanced the neoliberal corporate agenda every bit as much as his predecessors did. Let's not make this mistake again with Biden, says Chomsky. Keep up the pressure, and some good results may follow. But let us let Chomsky speak for himself. Here he is, interviewed in January 2021. The questions put to him are long and rambling, so I will translate them into English. To begin, with millions of Americans desperately needing relief from COVID-related financial distress, how can Congress so cavalierly say no?
Well, one place to look always is, where's the money? Who funds Congress? Actually, there's a very fine, careful study of this by the leading scholar who deals with funding issues in politics, Thomas Ferguson. He and his colleagues did a study about a year ago, careful study in which they investigated a simple question. What's the correlation over the years, many years, between campaign funding and electability to Congress? It's almost a straight line. It's the kind of close correlation that you rarely get in the social sciences. Greater the funding, higher the electability. You can find a few cases here and there that aren't right on the line, but it's from the standpoint of social science, it's a remarkable correlation. And in fact, we all know what happens when a congressional representative gets elected. First day in office, they start making phone calls to the potential donors for the next election coming up. Meanwhile, hordes of corporate lobbyists descend on their offices. They often have good staff people, often young kids, totally overwhelmed by the resources, the wealth, the power of the massive lobbyists who pour in. Out of that comes legislation, which the representative later signs, maybe even looks at occasionally. I wonder if he can get off the phone to the donors. What do you think? What kind of system do you expect to emerge from this? Well, we have good studies of it. So, for example, one recent, quite high-level study found that they analyzed by income as compared with decisions by their own representatives. For about 90% of the population, there's essentially no correlation. That is, they're fundamentally unrepresented. This extends earlier work by Martin Gillens, by Benjamin Page and others who found pretty similar results. This happens to be a little more detailed and sophisticated. But the general picture is clear. The working class, most of the middle class, are basically unrepresented. The decisions reflect a very highly concentrated campaign money, not just campaign funding, shows up in all sorts of other ways. I mean, if you're a congressional representative and you're going to leave Congress one of these days, either by decision or because you voted out, where do you go? Do you become a truck driver, secretary? Just take a look. Well, you know where you go and you know what the reasons are. If you voted the right way, you got a cushy future ahead of you. There are many, many devices by which you can ensure that the large majority of the population is unrepresented and furthermore robbed massively. I mean, the scale is colossal. We have plenty of information about this. The Rand Corporation, ultra respectable, a couple of months ago did a study of what they call the transfer of wealth, more accurately, the robbery of the public. Since the neoliberal assault began in around 1980, last 40 years, how much wealth has been transferred from the working class and the middle class? They used the same 90% figure, the lower 90% of the income scale, from them to the very top. And the very top actually means fraction of 1%. Their estimate is $47 trillion. It's not small change. And it's a vast underestimate. When Reagan opened the spigots for corporate robbery, it's called neoliberalism, many devices were opened. For example, tax havens, shell companies, illegal before that, and the Treasury Company and Department enforced the law. How much money was stolen that way? That's mostly secret. Private tyrannies don't let us know what they're doing. But there are some reasonable estimates. Actually, there's a IMF study that came out recently that estimated it maybe in the neighborhood of $35 trillion, roughly, just tax havens over 40 years. Well, keep adding this up. It's not pennies. And it affects people's lives. People are angry, resentful, very good reasons, perfect terrain for a demagogue to come along, Trump style, very effective, holds up a banner with one hand saying, I love you, I'm going to save you, other hand stabs you in the back to pay off the rich and powerful. That's what we've been seeing. It's an extreme example. Now, the Democratic National Committee is not that different. Different, but not that different, in the same game, essentially. So getting back to your question, I think these are the answers.
The next question is, we saw how Bernie Sanders was crushed, not by the Republicans, but by the Democratic Party leadership. What can we Sanders supporters do to fight back?
Well, the first thing we should remember is that the Sanders campaign was a remarkable success. I mean, within a couple of years, Sanders and others working with him or alongside him have managed to shift the range of issues and concerns that are at the center of attention very far towards the progressive side. That's quite significant. They did it with no funding, no corporate support, no media support. Actually, the media became mildly friendly to Sanders after he had lost the nomination, not before. Before, it was kind of like what happened to Corbyn in England, not maybe not that extreme, but something similar. Powerful forces determined to ensure that nothing will go to the left of the most mild social democracy. In fact, looking back at the success of his campaign, I think one answer to your question is keep at it. You can do a lot more of that. Remember, there was a terrible mistake that was made when Obama was elected. Namely, a lot of the left believed him, which was always a terrible error. Obama had a tremendous amount of popular support, especially from young people. Lots of young activists and organizers working to get him elected. The day after the election, what happened? They told him to go home. And unfortunately, they went home. We've got our man in the office. Now we'll have faith in the pretty rhetoric. So we'll go home. So the first thing he did was stab him in the back, of course, and betray them. And within 2 years, he had completely betrayed his constituency, and it showed up in the 2010 election. It's not that the right wing won the Labour vote. The Democrats lost it for good reasons. In the Kennedy replacement election in Massachusetts, liberal state, 2010, even union voters didn't vote for the Democratic candidate. They saw what Obama had done. Okay. Well, we shouldn't make that mistake again, certainly not with Biden. Biden's kind of a weak read, in my opinion. He can be pressed. The important part of the Biden administration, first of all, there are some quite good people in it, especially among the economic advisors, but they can be pressed. We saw it on some of the most important things. So take climate change. There isn't any more important issue. If we don't deal with the environmental catastrophe soon, everything else is moot. There won't be anything to talk about. A lot of pressure on the Biden-Harris campaign from Sunrise Movement, others, did manage to press their program toward the progressive side. Not far enough, but still the best program that's ever been produced. Not bad. That meant you could go further. The DNC started hacking away at it. It was pretty striking to watch what happened. I don't have inside information, so can only speculate from what you can see. But what you can see is, and I looked at it, I was looking at it regularly because I was giving lots of talks on the and interviews on the election. I kept looking at the Democratic program on the web through August. It prevented, when you looked up, when you Googled Democratic Party climate program, you got the Biden-Harris program. The last time I saw it was August 22nd. Next time I looked, a couple of days later, wasn't there. What you got is how to donate to the DNC. Well, we can guess what happened. I can only speculate. But I think that's the struggle that's going on. And it could continue if the left doesn't make the Obama mistake and believe those who are in power and their pretty words. The same is true of the corporate sector, incidentally, which is running scared. They're concerned with what they call reputational risks, meaning peasants are coming with the pitchforks. So all across the corporate world, you saw it at Davos, you saw it in the Business Roundtable group of corporate executives, there's discussions of how we have to confess to the public that we've done the wrong things. We haven't paid enough attention to the stakeholders workforce, community. But now we realize our errors. Now we've overcome them. Now we're humane and dedicated to everyone. Now we're becoming what in the 1950s was called soulful corporations, really dedicated to the common good. Forget all this business about making money. That's just on the side. So now we have lots of soulful corporations appealing to the public on their great humanity, sometimes taking measures like withdrawing funding from fossil fuel companies and so on. They can be pressed. Now, I don't like the system. You don't like the system, but it exists. Okay. And we have to work within it to change it. We can't say, I don't want it. Let's have another system that doesn't exist. And it can be done by pressure from inside and from outside. So, for example, there's no reason to avoid working to try to create an alternative political framework and social framework that ranges from a new party, true left party, to actions in the economy like taking over, creating worker-owned enterprises and cooperatives and all, localism and agriculture, all sorts of things. There's a point, there's a whole array of options open to us, and they all have to be pursued.
Question three, how can progressives better organize to confront politicians?
Well, the lack of influence goes back in the United States roughly 250 years. So we can start with the Constitution, which was established explicitly on the principle of preventing democracy. There wasn't any secret about it. I'm quite open about it. In fact, the major scholarly study, the gold standard for scholarship on the Constitutional Convention, Michael Klarman, Harvard Law professor, is called The Framers' Coup, the coup against democracy by the framers. It goes in detail. It's not a radical point of view. It just goes through the hundreds of pages of details of the discussions. Comes out very clearly. The theme of the founders basically was expressed quite well by John Jay, who was first Supreme Court Chief Justice. He said, those who own the country ought to govern it. That's what we see today in the matters we were just discussing. Those who own the country have succeeded in governing it, okay? It hasn't been a uniform procedure. There have been plenty of resistance and lots of victories have been won. So my childhood, for example, 1930s, there were major victories, mainly spearheaded by the organized labor movement. CIO organizing, militant strikes, militant labor actions, moderately sympathetic administration, a lot of political activism of all sorts. Some good things happened. US moved towards moderate social democracy. We're still enjoying some of the benefits of that. A lot of it's been chipped away. Well, no reason why that can't, and there are other periods of American history that are similar. The late 19th century, one of the most radical popular movements in US history developed. Knights of Labor, the populist movement has nothing to do with what's called populism today. Radical farmers, they were getting together, a major movement, finally crushed by force, state and corporate force, but with a residue. This is fundamentally a class struggle that goes on through history, you know. And we're in a particular stage of it. Well, to say we're disappointed because we haven't succeeded is like saying we're in the world. Yes, we keep struggling, make improvements, some regression, keep going. Slavery was overcome after hundreds of years of struggle, then it came back in another form. It's still, the residue's still there. But it's not that there's no victory at all. Yeah, there are. Things are better than they were. because of constant struggle. In fact, this country is a lot better than it was 50 years, 60 years ago, mainly because of the activism of the 60s. Just remember what the country was in the 1960s. I mean, the country had anti-miscegenation laws so extreme that the Nazis refused to accept them because they were too extreme. Federal funded housing by law barred Afro-Americans, not because the liberal senators wanted that, but because you couldn't get anything through the Southern Democratic stranglehold on policy. Social Security was designed to exclude Afro-Americans, domestic workers, agricultural workers. I mean, there were anti-sodomy laws into this century. Now, lots of things have changed. Not easy, but if you say, well, we haven't gotten where we wanted, I'm going to quit, you just guarantee that the worst is going to happen. It's a constant struggle, and it can be done at every level. For, as I said, take say, Tony Mazzocchi, one of the heroes of modern labor and environmentalism, head of the Oil, Chemical, Atomic Workers Union, one of the first serious environmentalists in the country. His constituents are right at the front line, being murdered by pollution, destruction of the environment, and so on. This is the early 70s, way before the environmental movement took off. His union, under his leadership, was working very strongly to move towards dealing with the environmental crisis, moved on to try to establish a labor party in the 90s. It could have worked, didn't make it. The neoliberal assault, beginning with Reagan on through Clinton, Obama, was designed to destroy labor. Every step of the way, moves were made to undermine the labor movement. It was explicit. Reagan's campaign opened with an attack on the labor unions, even bringing in scabs to destroy strikes. Corporations quickly picked it up. Thatcher did exactly the same thing in England. The people behind the neoliberal assault understood what they were doing. You have to eliminate the ability of laboring people to defend themselves if you want to crush them the way it's been done. So that was the first step. It's been quite successful. Clinton extended it. His neoliberal globalization policies were designed to protect investors and to crush labor, and they did it. And that's similar to the 30s. In the 1920s, labor had been virtually crushed. US has a very violent labor history, much worse than comparable countries. It's a business-run society to an unusual extent. There was a militant, successful labor movement, early part of the 20th century, after Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare was almost destroyed. 1920s, it was almost nothing there. Came roaring back in the 30s. That's what led to the New Deal policies, the mild social democracy that we still benefit from. Well, that can be done again. In fact, it's beginning to happen in quite interesting ways. Labor had been so crushed by the neoliberal policies that there barely were any strikes. Workers were afraid to go on strike. They'd be destroyed. Started to pick up in red states, ununionized labor. Teachers in West Virginia and Arizona, enormous public support. I'm in Arizona. When the teachers began to strike, there was popular support all over the place. You look all over lawns, there's, you know, posters saying, support the teachers, you know. And they weren't just calling for higher salaries, which they very much deserve, but calling for improving the educational system, which has been very harshly hit by the neoliberal plague. One part of it has been aimed at the educational system. Privatization, defunding, regimentation, teaching to test, all of these things, bipartisan. I mean, Republicans are more extreme. So Betty DeVos was almost openly devoted to destroying the whole system. Doesn't have to be that bad, but Obama's policies weren't much better if you want to look at them. Here's the teacher strike, lots of popular support, nurses strikes, service unions, sometimes ununionized, sometimes opposed by the unions, but taking off, it's affected other elements of the working class, big GM strike, and more of that could happen. The destruction of labor has been a major factor in the extreme inequality. There's some mainstream economists like Lawrence Summers who've concluded that it's the major factor in the extreme inequality, just taking away the ability of workers to defend themselves. Certainly a major factor. That can come back. Alternative political parties like Mizaki's could come back. Pressure on the Democrats to move to the left, like the kind of thing that Ocasio-Cortez squad, others are doing, that can have an effect. It's got to have a lot of popular action behind it. If the troops go home, say, I'm disappointed, I didn't get what I wanted, it's going to move to the right. There's one force that's relentless. They never stop. The business classes are Marxists, dedicated Marxists. They're fighting a vicious class war all the time. They never stop. If they have an opportunity, they'll move ahead. If the rest of the population leaves the struggle, you know what's going to happen. In fact, we've seen 40 years of it.
Here we must pause part one of Noam Chomsky, speaking in January 2021 on Where Should the Left Go After Trump? The original talk on the Jacobin channel on YouTube was gently edited for radio by yours truly. You can find a copy of this and most other installments of New World Notes at our website, which remains, and I quote, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again for more of Noam Chomsky next week. Till then.